genocide, where Israel has created the conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of Palestinians. And so they coldly talk about private property rights as if, and compensation, as if this genocidal war that we've all witnessed for over 2 years never happened. But essentially, you know, that's the vision of what's to come. We heard Jared Kushner say, you know, we're not going to do the free zone and the Hamas zone. And he's referring to those two sides of the yellow line, which is kind of how it stands. You know, one side where most Palestinians are and the other side that's controlled by Israel. He said, you know, we want catastrophic success. And you saw the rendering showing all of Gaza. I don't think that's what's actually going to happen. We're seeing now, as I mentioned before, there's a trench literally being built that's splitting Gaza in half. Israel is consolidating control. And what you're going to have is these Orwellian housing zones where Israel and outside forces have complete economic, social, and security control over every aspect of the lives of a new generation of dispossessed Palestinians who are corralled into these spaces. And then in this kind of like other half of Gaza, you're going to be left with Palestinians living in a wasteland where no construction is allowed to be conducted, that's under constant assault by Israeli bombs, where there's hardly any food, there's hardly any shelter, and they're, you know, left to survive under conditions of genocide. Sharif, and this is the future that they're trying to write for Gaza.
Sharif, we just have a minute, but I had to ask you about the attacks that continue in Gaza, killing at least 11 Palestinians Wednesday, including three journalists who were working with the Egyptian Committee for Gaza Relief. Mohammed Keshta, Abdul Rauf Shath, and Anas Gunaim were killed when an Israeli missile struck their vehicle. Shath was a contributor to CBS News, Agence France-Presse. He had just gotten married. Mohammed Mansour of the Egyptian Committee for Gaza Relief condemned Israel's attack on the journalists. This is what he said.
What happened is a very big crime committed by the Israeli army by targeting a crew belonging to the Egyptian committee. This crew was not firing rockets nor fighting the Israeli army. The Egyptian committee's crew was in a humanitarian mission. This crew is searching day and night for a shelter to house our people.
Sharif, can you tell us about these three journalists? Again, according to the International Federation of Journalists, at least something like 258 journalists and media workers have been killed in Gaza in the last 2 years.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is Mohammed Ishta, Anas Ghunaim, and Abdul Rauf Shath, who actually was a freelance cameraman, longtime cameraman for CBS News and Agence France-Presse. And they were killed while they were in their car recording footage of a tent encampment for displaced people in central Gaza. They were killed about a mile away from that camp. The Egyptian committee that hired them, that they were working for, said the car was clearly marked, and yet the Israelis bombed it anyway. And this is part of a pattern that we've seen over the past 2 years, where the Israeli military has killed an unprecedented number of journalists with complete impunity. And it came as world leaders are gathering in Davos and talking about, you know, so-called board of peace and so forth. And it's sad to say that these types of killings of journalists, of Palestinian civilians every day, hardly make waves anymore. It's become normalized in the world for Palestinians to die. And the world has allowed this to happen. And this is, you know, yet another blow to the journalistic community in Gaza that has suffered more than we've seen, you know, in any part of the world in generations.
And more than just a blow to the journalists of Gaza, but to the journalists of the world. Sharif Abdelkaddous, we thank you so much for being with us. Award-winning journalist, Middle East, North Africa editor at Dropsite News. We'll link to your piece, headlined Leaked Documents, Planned Community Rafah Would Force Palestinians into Israeli Panopticon. Next up, we go to Minneapolis. We'll speak with the lawyer for Nakima Levy Armstrong, who's still in jail after being arrested for peacefully protesting in a St. Paul church where a top ICE official serves as pastor. Stay with us. Ali Aslan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Outrage is growing in Columbia Heights, Minnesota, after ICE agents detained a five-year-old boy named Liam Ramos and his father, who's an asylum seeker. Photos from the scene show a masked agent standing next to Liam, who is wearing a backpack and a blue winter hat with bunny ears. He just returned from preschool. The father and son were then quickly sent to a detention facility in Texas. On Thursday, Vice President J.D. Vance went to Minneapolis and defended ICE for targeting the boy's father and detaining the preschooler.
So the story is that ICE detained a five-year-old. Well, what are they supposed to do? Are they supposed to let a five-year-old child freeze to death?
Local officials in Columbia Heights condemned the detention of five-year-old Liam. Rachel James serves on Columbia Heights City Council. She described efforts by neighbors to protect the boy.
Heard one neighbor say, I live in this house. I'm part of this family. I can take him. Let him come to me. I heard another neighbor on the other side say, I have the forms. His mom signed the forms. Let me have him. I know him. I know him. I kept saying, stop, wait. He can go with us. He can go with the teachers. And then they took him over to the car and he was just standing there. And then they quickly put him in the back seat and drove away.
On Thursday, the lawyer for the Ramos family, Mark Prokosh, said Liam and his father had come to the U.S. in 2024 from Ecuador to seek asylum.
Liam and his dad did enter the United States at a port of entry to seek asylum through the CBP One app at the Brownsville border crossing. So they did everything right when they came in. They used the app, they made an appointment, they came to the border and presented themselves to Customs and Border Patrol. They've shared all of their information with the government, and they were following the process. They were just trying to secure safety and persecution for their family from their home country. But ICE didn't care about the fact that they had those pending claims and then just arrested them.
This comes as hundreds of businesses are expected to close today as part of an economic blackout to protest the surge of ICE agents in Minnesota. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But first, we're getting an update on how the prominent Minneapolis civil rights attorney, activist, and ordained minister, Nakima Levy Armstrong, and two others were arrested on federal charges for their role in peacefully protesting inside a St. Paul church where one of the pastors, David Easterwood, also leads the local ICE field office in the Twin Cities area.
David Easterwood is a pastor here. He is also the director of the field office for ICE in St. Paul. So someone who claims to worship God, teaching people in this church about God, is out there overseeing ICE agents.
The activists involved in the protests now face charges under the FACE Act. That's the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, a law written to protect abortion clinics. Attorney General Pam Bondi announced Levy Armstrong's arrest. Then the White House posted an AI-generated image to make it appear Levy Armstrong was crying after arrest. The Justice Department also attempted to bring charges against the journalist and former CNN anchor Don Lemon, who covered the church protests, but a federal magistrate judge rejected the request. We go now to Minneapolis, where we're joined by Jordan Kushner, civil rights and criminal defense attorney who is helping to represent Nakima. We thank you so much for being with us, Jordan. If you can start off, you were with her when she was arrested. Is that right? Can you talk about the AI-generated image? Can you talk about her wanting, saying that she would turn herself in, but they said no, because they said they were after her over the last few days, and what she was doing in that church?
That's correct. Although the arrest was a horrible ordeal, she was and some other people in her group were staying in a hotel. The group of FBI and Homeland Security agents busted into the hotel the night before her arrest, roughed people up. They were thrown out by the management. Later on at 3 a.m, someone left Nakima Levy Armstrong's room. The police agents tackled her violently and took her to a detention facility before they realized that she wasn't Nakima Levy Armstrong. So she was obviously terrified about turning herself in. A legal team, including myself, went to the hotel that morning. We reached out to agents to try and arrange for her to turn herself in voluntarily at the federal courthouse, which was only about 6 blocks away. They put the U.S. Attorney for the District of Minnesota, Trump appointee Dan Rosen, on the he called me himself. I made my request to him. He said it was very reasonable, and he was just going to call me back in a few minutes with the specific logistics. Then he calls back and says, oh, we're not going to let her turn herself in. We need to arrest her at the hotel. So she needs to voluntarily leave the hotel room and turn herself in. So after he talked to his bosses in D.C., he had completely reneged on his commitment. They then sent agents up there to the hotel room to arrest her. One of the agents was filming the arrest. As they put her in handcuffs, he was filming it on his cell phone. Never seen anything like that. They can have their body cameras. This was completely unprofessional. He said he was just doing it because of instructions, and he promised it wasn't going to go on Twitter. Nevertheless, it went on Twitter. It went on the Department of Justice's Twitter, so this was their trophy. And then, as you said, the White House subsequently altered the video to make it look like she was crying. I observed the whole arrest. She was dignified, rational, calm, and reasonable the whole time. It just shows the complete political motivation of the government making this a circus. This has nothing to do with enforcing the law. It has nothing to do with protecting anyone's religious rights. It's all about... It's about, frankly, just about fascism. I mean, fascism means part of that is that the government makes their own narrative. They invent reality, and they're literally doing that with an AI video. And so what this is about,
And Jordan, I wanted to ask you if you could talk about the charge that they that she's been arrested on, and basically a statute that has its roots in the Reconstruction era and to prosecute members of the KKK for terrorizing Black Americans.
Yeah, she's charged with conspiracy to violate civil rights, or excuse me, conspiracy to violate constitutional rights of other people. Namely, the claim is that by protesters going into a church to raise objections to how this church conducted its business, with Nikema Levy Armstrong being a reverend herself, that somehow deprived the people of the church of their right to freedom of worship. It is a farce. It was passed to really protect people's constitutional rights. That's what she's charged with. The government also sought to charge her with another offense under the FACE Act, which involved, obstruction of someone else's exercise of their religious practices. The magistrate refused to sign on to that charge. So we're left with the conspiracy to violate constitutional rights. This was an exercise of free speech. They were exercising their own constitutional rights. It's unheard of for people to be charged with a criminal offense for a free speech protest like that. That's a legal, peaceful protest.
Jordan, yeah. I was just watching Right Reverend Craig Loya, who's the 10th bishop of the Episcopal Church in Minnesota. He talked about what's happening, the immigration crackdown, as a campaign of reckless cruelty. He refused to condemn what Nikema had done, said that it's time, and we've seen this with the Catholic bishops as well, saying it's time for us to, he said, put our bodies on the line. I want to end just by saying we wanted to have Nikema on this morning, but she's still not out of jail. We have 10 seconds.
Yeah, the magistrate ordered her release. The government did a maneuver where they appealed. So it's being reviewed by a judge and waiting for a judge decision about whether she's going to be released. So the government used more manipulative tactics to keep her in jail when there was no basis whatsoever. No one is detained on a case like this.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Others arrested included Shanti Louisa Allen, a St. Paul school board member, and activist William Kelly. Jordan Kushner, thanks so much for being with us. Civil rights and criminal defense attorney representing Nikema Levy Armstrong, who's still in jail after being arrested last Sunday, after being arrested yesterday for peacefully protesting a St. Paul church Sunday, where a top ICE official serves as a pastor. We're going to stay in Minneapolis for the next 2 minutes, where we're joined joined by a union leader. Many people are saying today they plan to do nothing. They're not going to go to work or school or shop or as part of an economic blackout to protest the surge of ICE agents in the state. It's being called a day of truth and freedom. Some call it a general strike. Organizers include faith leaders, scores of unions, including the AFL-CIO. We go to Kieran Knutson, president of the CWA, Local 7250. Lay out what you're calling for.
Thanks a lot for having me, Amy. Today, after weeks of living under the heavy weight of this racist campaign of terror by ICE agents in the Twin Cities that have torn apart families, have brutalized people and murdered people, today the working class of Minnesota, of the Twin Cities, is standing up and refusing to go to work, refusing to go to school, refusing to shop. And for once, we're going to flex our muscle that we contribute to this society every day. Nothing runs without the working class in this country. And today, we're going to show our power.
And what specifically are you calling for people to do? And how was the coalition built around this issue?
Well, in the Twin Cities, there's been activism and organizing of this generation, you know, going back to prior to the George Floyd uprising. Of course, the George Floyd uprising was a key moment in Minnesota's history, in this country's history. And many of the organizers have, you know, experience from that. And that created a network of organization and experience and confidence to be able to go forward with this kind of organizing. This has never been done before, though. This is unprecedented in our generation, where we're asking people not to go to work. And there's going to be hundreds of thousands of workers today that will not go to work because they support the demand for ICE out. ICE is deeply unpopular in the Twin Cities, even hated because of their brutality, because of their tactics, because of the murder of Renee Good. And today is a chance to actually use our power in a way that will catch the attention of those rich and powerful who, you know, live off of our labor every day, and it's going to show the community what power we do have and what we can do to fight back against ICE.
Kieran Knutson, we want to thank you so much for being with us, president of the Communications Workers of America, Local 7250. Next up, well, today, 50 years ago, Paul Robeson died, the acclaimed actor, singer, activist. We're going to speak with the author Howard Bryant about his new book, Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. Stay with us. Crucified My Lord, sung by Paul Robeson. He died 50 years ago today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Yes, today marks the 50th anniversary of the death of the great actor, singer, athlete, scholar Paul Robeson. At one point, he was world famous. You probably recognize his voice from this 1936 film, Showboat.
There's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man that I'd like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? Old Man River, that old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing.
Robeson singing Old Man River and performing in Showboat. Yes, Paul Robeson was the son of an escaped slave. He was attacked, blacklisted, and hounded by the government for his political beliefs. For years, Paul Robeson was tracked by the FBI as well as the CIA, the Department of State, numerous other government agencies. Together, they compiled tens of thousands of documents on him, which they used to bring him before McCarthy's HUAC. That's the House Un-American Activities Committee. In 1949, Robeson was effectively blacklisted. In 1950, the government revoked his passport. For 8 years, he was barred from travel, a prisoner in his own country. Now, Jackie Robinson, the Brooklyn Dodgers star who'd integrated the all-white major baseball leagues, was hailed as a national hero in 1949 for testifying against Robeson before HUAC.
I've been asked to express my views on Paul Robeson's statements in Paris.
One man is now a legend. The other was erased from history.
Today, we look at the fascinating new book out this week, Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. We're joined now by the book's author, Howard Bryant, currently the sports correspondent for Weekend Edition at National Public Radio, also the author of over 15 other books. Howard, welcome to Democracy Now! What an amazing book, the story that you tell. Tell us the story of Paul Robeson and Jackie Robinson, how you decided to focus on both and what they tell us about America.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me on the show. It really does feel like what is past is prologue. So much of working on this book of Paul Robeson, who, of course, was a victim in the center of a lot of the McCarthyist tactics that we see today, facing off against Jackie Robinson, who really did feel compelled by his employer, by Branch Rickey, the president of the Brooklyn Dodgers, to testify against Robeson to show that African Americans were loyal to the United States after Paul Robeson had given a speech in Paris in 1949. These two giants who had never met one another were really placed in opposition to one, you know, to each other in front of the most notorious government body that this country's ever produced. And this book is really the story of these two giants on opposite sides of the political spectrum in 1949, but actually had much, much, much more in common than we would have thought.
And could you talk about why Branch Rickey tried to insist that Robinson testify, especially given the fact that the, for instance, the Communist Party had played a major role in attempting to integrate baseball in the 1940s.
That's right. Well, I think that's exactly why. I think once when the amazing thing, one of the things I really enjoyed about working on this book was how Branch Rickey's version of the integration story has essentially been treated as the only version. And so much of his motivation for signing Jackie Robinson, at least the public version, had been that Rickey had this amazing moral compass, when actually the biggest reason that he felt compelled, he did have a moral compass here. He did really, you know, go up against his fellow owners who saw signing Robinson as a huge betrayal of them. They wanted to keep the game all white. But one of the biggest reasons was the fact that Branch Rickey in Brooklyn, huge labor area, really progressive, very strong left-wing progressive politics. They were pressuring the Dodgers more than any other team in baseball to be the ones to integrate. And Rickey really had no, I wouldn't say he had no choice, but he absolutely was under pressure. It wasn't simply just his moral compass. It was the fact that the pressure from political groups from the progressive side really, really pushed to make this happen. That's how movements change.
And in terms of the what Robinson actually said in Congress, and did he have second thoughts later in life about his role?
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things for Jackie Robinson was the fact that he never wanted to testify in the first place. He felt obligated to Branch Rickey. And later on, after he had testified against Paul Robeson and after the violence that had that had come after his testimony. Two very bloody riots in Peekskill, New York, followed Jackie's testimony. And his legacy never really survived this. It was something he didn't really want to do, but he felt a loyalty to Branch Rickey. He felt a loyalty to say something on behalf of Black Americans. And his widow, Rachel Robinson, who, by the way, is still alive at 103 today, believed that that there was nothing that that Jackie would have wanted to take back more. Between that and his support of Richard Nixon in 1960, that these were the two pieces of advice that that Rachel Robinson felt that that did not help Jackie and haven't helped his legacy.
Howard, we have students come in to watch the show every week, and a group of eighth graders came in, and I said, how many of you have heard, I said you were going to be on the show, have heard of Jackie Robinson? Almost everyone raised their hand. I said, how many of you have heard of Paul Robeson? And almost no one raised their hand. So I think it's really important for you to give us the history of Paul Robeson. He was perhaps the most famous Black American in the world at a certain point. And talk about what it meant for him to have been so gone after by the CIA, the FBI, and having his passport revoked because he was a world-famous actor and singer.
Yeah, I think it's a great example of what is, once again, what is past is prologue, and what you feel is impossible is very possible. I think one of the things that I wanted to do with this book was to really make it clear how similar the times were between the 1940s and the Paul Robeson McCarthy era, and what is happening today in terms of the assault on education and higher education, the assault on civil liberties, the forcing of loyalty oaths, all of this playbook, the closing of the borders. So much of what is taking place that took place then is taking place now. And when you look at somebody like Paul Robeson, who is a giant, who is one of the most accomplished Americans this country's ever produced, he is not just the talk about Jackie Robinson integrating the major leagues in 1947. Well, Paul Robeson integrated Broadway in 1943. Paul Robeson was a lawyer, a Columbia-educated lawyer. He played in the National Football League. He was one of the greatest college football players of all time as an All-American in 1917 and 1918. This is a giant of a man. And so to see how powerful those political forces are that silenced him and really did everything it could to erase him so these young kids today don't know who he is tells you about the importance of maintaining stories. And as the great Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus has always said, history writes people out of the story, and it's our job to write them back in. And 50 years after Paul Robeson's death, it's time for a reappraisal of one of the great Americans.
And in 1949, Life magazine ran a spread of people they considered dangerous and un-American. The list included figures like Langston Hughes and Albert Einstein. Can you talk about the parallels you see with the media in 2026 and the complacency and even cooperation with the Trump administration?
Well, complacency, cooperation, and that was one of the things that was so compelling about working on this, because the history is not some old relic. It's not really dusty. Every time I was working on a chapter, I said, this feels like today, and this sounds like today, and this sounds like today. And when you look at the complacency that we have today, so many people look back at that time and said, how did we allow that to happen? But the same thing is happening right now. You see the, especially in media, and especially with the public, I think people become numb to it. And
Howard,
if it's not happening to them specifically.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I thank you so much. People have to pick up your book and read the rest. It is fantastic. It's called Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. That does it for our show. Happy early birthday to Tarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablis.
Are you an artist, band, or record label? We want you to send us your music so we can put it on the radio. Not only this station, but stations across Canada. Check out earshot-distro.ca and share your music with more than 100 radio stations and programmers across the country. Earshot Distro is made by and for the campus community radio sector to help emerging musicians. Uploads cost $7 per song or $50 per album. Learn more at earshot-distro.ca.